This is a Triple J podcast.
How come reptiles can bask in the sun and not get sunburnt? Why does lasagna or pasta taste better as leftovers? And what's the best way to clean grease? We tap into these and more on this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. Thanks for joining us. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's jump in. Tamara in the Hunter Valley. Now, Tamara, your kid kind of discovered something pretty interesting recently. What happened?
She did. Good morning. We were at a like a digestive system workshop at Newcastle Museum recently. And at the end of the workshop, they gave us a piece of paper to place on our tongues. And I didn't react to it at all. But my daughter reacted quite aggressively to it and said it tasted like hand sanitizer. And they told her that she was actually a super taster.
Wow.
My question is basically, what is a super taster? Because I know we all have taste sensations. Does this mean that she's got an accelerated sense of taste? And how do you become a super taster?
Whoa. Obviously, you've got to be able to taste the outside world, so you get a hint of what is good and bad for you. And most foods have got some sort of sweetness about them in the wild, the berries, etc. So we have evolved to eat them. We spread the berry seeds where they come out of our back end, but we get nutrition because we are attracted to the sweetness. So we all have a sense of taste. It's broken into five main categories, which are sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and the other one being umami. A super taster has extra. There's two ways to find whether you're a super taster. One is to give you something really a special sort of bitter to see if you notice it or not. Is that what happened with your daughter, that she had that?
Yeah, she did. She had quite a strong reaction to it, and she said it tasted quite she said hand sanitizer, so.
Ah, okay, that's not quite bitter. So there are advantages and disadvantages to being a super taster. The advantage to being a super taster is, in this particular category, is that you will register bitter things very strongly, mm-hmm. and that then you will reject them. And this is an advantage for you pre-puberty and into puberty and having children, because you are more likely to stay alive, because many foods in nature that are bitter are also poisonous. So in your earlier years, being a super taster is an advantage in the wild, because it gives you a better survival chance of rejecting poisons. But in later life, it's a disadvantage. It turns out that many of the bitter chemicals, such as the sinigrins, S-I-N-E-G-R-I-N-S, in the brassica-type vegetables, you know, the, Brussels sprouts and those sort of things, they have anti-cancer properties, very weak anti-cancer properties, but they will protect you in later years. So it swings and roundabouts.
Okay.
So it can protect you and be an advantage and a disadvantage depending.
How interesting. Thanks, Tamara.
No worries. Thank you.
I want to be a super taster.
George Bush famously said that he was an adult now and he was president of the United States, and he could say he didn't want to eat broccoli, and so he wouldn't. And that led to a sales drop in broccoli across the entire USA, and they sent several truckloads of broccoli to the White House, and he had to kind of do a bit of an apology thing.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry to Big Broccoli for, rejecting you. But I think we've spoken about this before on the show, how, you know, I can look at that computer mouse and I know what it's going to taste like.
Ah,
have we spoken about this before?
No.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
You know, you just know that it's going to taste like plastic, or it's going to have I don't know. It's a funny thing. I know what that cardboard box is going to and taste like if I put my tongue on it.
Well, that's because you've got a memory of what these things have tasted like over time.
Okay.
Okay, so she's got a daughter who's a super taster.
Super taster.
And also, almost the next question. I was thinking of something else.
Okay, we've got Zach from Barara here. Zach. Now, Zach, you've got a question about sunburn. What's up?
Yeah, so I was just wondering why it takes such a short amount of time for you to get burnt from, anything hot, and it takes so long for it to cool down afterwards.
So you're not talking about being burnt by the sun or being burnt by, say, a hot cast iron fry pan or?
Yeah, either or, yeah. Mm.
And so you're getting damage to your skin, and if the temperature's above, I think, about 50, 60 degrees C, you get denaturing of the proteins, which can be permanent. So in modern houses over the last 30, 40 years, the temperature is set to a maximum of 55 degrees. If it's set to 60, you can get permanent irreversible damage. 55, you're getting reversible damage.
Are we talking about with water?
With water. Yeah. So the damage is that you got several layers in your skin. The proteins can break apart. It's not the water boiling and expanding, but rather the protein layers are splitting apart, and you can get permanent damage to the layers where they don't stick to each other. So what specifically are you inquiring about, Zach? Is it...
So say you like burnt your hand on the stove, like, you know, it only takes a second, and then you've got to put your hand under cold water for like maybe 5 minutes, whatever, to be able to cool that down. So, yeah, why is it such a long amount of time to cool it down?
It is, and I don't know why, but I think it's because you've activated the pain sensors, and the pain sensors, even though you've stopped the permanent damage from setting in by cooling it down to that lower temperature, the pain sensors have been triggered. I'm guessing the pain sensors have been triggered, and they will stay triggered, and what you've got to do is anaesthetize the little buggers. You've got to, so cold running water is good, and then you anaesthetize them, and then when they wake up again, they've forgotten the previous pain impulse. I think that's the case. If there is a scientist who specialises in pain, could you please ring in to give Zach a better answer?
You know, I can go outside midday in summer and get burnt in 10 minutes if I'm not wearing sunscreen, but then that'll take 2 to 3 days to cool down a bit, or to at least minimise.
In that case, you're looking at the phenomenon called inflammation. And inflammation is like a 3-week course in medical school. And if you look it up in Wikipedia, it's a big fat entry. It'll take you a few hours to read. Short-term inflammation is good. Mm. Inflammation in the short term opens up the blood vessels and triggers a whole bunch of things in your immune system. So the good guy chemicals want to get in, and because the blood vessels have been opened up, can get in. Long-term chronic inflammation is bad. So it's like a short-term response that is good in the short term. So when you've been sunburnt, you get the short-term inflammation, but then it stays there, and that's the bad thing.
Is inflammation what happens when you burn yourself?
That's part of the, well, there's an overall response called inflammation, which is a whole coordinated thing which involves, surprisingly, even your immune system throwing in cells to have macrophages to go and eat the bad guy chemicals that get produced as a result of the sunburn. So it's a complicated thing. It's not just opening up the blood vessels.
Okay.
That's why it takes 3 weeks in medical school to learn it.
Thanks, Zach.
Thank you, Dr. Zag.
I'll never forget when I worked at a fast food restaurant. It was the day before the Year 10 formal, and a little drop of oil went up from the fry machine and hit me on the eyebrow, so then I couldn't get my brows waxed for the formal. Can you believe?
Mate, if you can, my daughter's taught me the importance of eyebrows.
Honestly, they're perfect. Ariel on the Sunshine Coast.
Dr. Ariel, welcome.
What's your question?
Hi, guys. I was wondering why snakes or reptiles that bask in the sun for many hours of the day don't develop skin cancers like we see in animals and many other, I guess, humans, dogs.
Yeah, why are they getting sunburned?
I'm guessing that they've evolved against it by a combination of a thick skin with dead layers on the outside that absorb the ultraviolet so that it doesn't get through the skin. So outside the atmosphere, the sun is about 10% ultraviolet. So of the whole energy in the sunlight, 10% is ultraviolet. By the time it gets down to the ground, there's about 2%. And if it penetrates through the thin, dead layer in your skin, it can then go into the cell. So your skin cells start off as columns, and they migrate towards the surface to the outside. And as they migrate, as they die and then have babies, and each successive generation gets shorter and shorter, so they go from columns into sort of blobs, circular blobs, into flattened cobblestones and then dead.
Mm-hmm.
So the very outside layer is dead. It's not alive. There is no metabolic activity going in it. There's no DNA. It's just a dead thin layer, very thin, and hopefully it will absorb some of the ultraviolet. Now, how you get particularly with the tan. So imagine you've got a cobblestone street, you know, like a flat street. There's maybe 100 cobblestones in it. And then in the middle, you've got one cell called a melanocyte, and it puts out little tendrils like an octopus between all the other normal non-melanocyte cells, just normal skin cells. And it leaks out this chemical called melanin, which leaks out of the tendrils and then goes into the cells and actually is in the normal skin cells. And then it goes into the dead skin cells, and it will absorb some of the ultraviolet. So a tan, on one hand, is an indicator of skin damage, but on the other hand, the tan absorbs the incoming ultraviolet. and it stops it from penetrating into the cells that are alive. And what it does to the cells that are alive is that it can damage the DNA in a specific part of the DNA that's involved in repair. So it damages the repair mechanism. So your DNA divides. It looks like a ladder with 3 billion, B for billion, rungs. And when it makes a copy of itself, there's always some mistakes, and the repair mechanism snips them out, and the ultraviolet damages that repair mechanism. And so you've got abnormal DNA, which can then later down the line lead to a skin cancer. So having the thick layer absorbs it, the ultraviolet. I'm guessing with the snakes, their thicker dead layer, their dead layer of skin is thicker. So you might get a very sharp blade, don't do this experiment at home, and just cut their skin, and there'll be no blood coming out of it because you're cutting through non-living flesh, like a, it's somewhere between soft, naked flesh, like on the inside of your mouth, and the shell of a turtle. Mm. So it's somewhere on that scale towards the softer end. That's what I'm guessing is going on.
Sure. Awesome. Thanks so much.
And if you've got a herpetologist listening, please tell me where I was wrong in that guess of my explanation. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Teb here in Tassie. Now, Teb, universal question. What have you got?
Morning, doctors. Lasagna. Most of the time, all of us have been told that lasagna is always better the day after. The day after, the fridge, or a couple of days after. So why is it? What's happening? Like, what's the chemical? Is there a chemical reaction? And last of all, can we replicate that in a short-term period?
Oh, wow. Is the same thing true with curries, Dr. Teb? Have you noticed that with curries? They get better after a day?
I've mostly noticed it through, like, tomato-based things like lasagna or, like, bolognese.
Right. And by the way, you know that if you've got a plastic container, you could coat the container with a little bit of olive oil to stop the lycopene chemical from the tomato permanently staining the plastic vessel. But
yes,
talking about a different thing, what I'm guessing, and I'm not a food chemist, is that you're getting chemical changes that happen slowly over time, even in the refrigerator. They will happen, but more slowly, and then you end up with more delicious chemicals. I do not know the names of these chemicals, but it is well known in our family that curries taste better the next day, even after you've put them in the fridge. And I've often wondered about that, thinking, but reactions double in their speed for every 10 degree rise in temperature. So when you put them in the fridge, you're dropping them from room temperature of, say, 20 down to 10 or 4, so they're slowing down by a factor of 2 or 3. The reactions are slowing down an awful lot. But there must be chemical reactions coming on, which luckily for us make it taste better. I do not know the names of the chemicals. Where is our food chemist to ring in and save our bacon on this occasion? Do you see that terrible pun there? Bacon, yeah. Food, yeah, sorry about that.
But I do like it.
Okay.
But it's true, it takes so, even 2 days later, just everything's just so much more enriched. And
yeah, but you can't leave it on the stove.
The other possibility is with the fats cooling and expanding and solidifying. Does the fat pull any chemicals out of the meat or the oils or things like that that will change the structure?
Yes. You've answered the question yourself. You've come up with a wonderful hypothesis there. And then the other thing is the concept of the mouth feel, which is something you'll notice with different types of chocolate. There are 6 different crystalline forms of chocolate, which melt at temperatures between 17 and 36 degrees C. And that term mouthfeel is something that's very important in the appreciation of food. And that could be happening with the fats, changing their structure in the cold. Once again, out of my depth. Come on down, food chemist, ring in.
Teb, love that question. We've got Lachlan on the Central Coast. Lachlan, you got a question about fog.
Yeah, it was just simple. How does fog appear and how does it stick around? Why does it stick around for like hours like it does sometimes?
So what you've got to have is that you've got to have the temperature low enough so that the water molecules can stick together. I think it's around 4 degrees centigrade or something like that. If, however, you're dealing with stuff coming out of your mouth, that's at 37 degrees C and it's super saturated. It's already saturated with water. So even if you drop it down to, say, 10 degrees C, that's enough for the fog to appear. You also need tiny particles of dust in the atmosphere to act as nucleation centres. And also for the fog to hang around, you need to have virtually zero wind. So fog is kind of like cloud at ground level. Now, this is what I learned from the people in the meteorology department, and I might have forgotten one or two things. This was back from when I was a TV weatherman.
Okay.
So you need those the moisture in the air, because if you're having perfectly dry air, like in the outback deserts, you're not going to get fog. And you need the cooling, and then you need the nucleation centres. They're the three major factors. And, of course, low wind, because otherwise the fog will just blow away.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Lachlan.
And once I was driving from Sydney to Wollongong, and I was the only car that had fog lights. And, you know, going across the top on Madden's Plains.
Damn.
And all that sort of stuff. And so I had really good fog lights, because this was back in when I was a rally driver and navigator thingy. And the cars were just pulled over and they followed me heading down towards Wollongong from Sydney in the fog. And then I got the turning wrong and I accidentally turned left up to Sublime Point.
Oh.
And about 30 cars followed me in a little conga line. We went all the way to Sublime Point, did a UN, come back down again, and then finally came down Mount Ousley and then out of the fog.
Like, sorry, guys.
Sorry, guys.
Oh, driving down Mount Ousley in the fog, that's gnarly, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hectic. We've got Emily in Sydney here. Now, Emily, I think you're about to melt our brains with this question. What's going on?
Hi, so I'm just wondering, how do phones record both video and sound?
We digitise it. So firstly, think about the classic TV signal where you start at the top left and you put down a dot. And that dot can have a certain colour and a brightness. And so there's maybe 300 bits of information, 256 bits of information. Then you go to the next dot and you record another 256 bits of information for colour and brightness, and altogether going across, there's roughly 1,000 dots. And then you come down and you do it again on the next line, and you've got maybe 720 lines. So 720 multiplied by 1,000 is a lot of dots. And then each dot has got 256 bits of information. And that's how they record video. They scan the incoming light, and they do this sort of breaking it up into individual little pixels, record the information, and they record it as ones and noughts. And way back in the old days, the computers weren't fast enough to do it digitally, and you could see them sort of going dot, 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 building it up on the screen. Nowadays, of course, the processes are much faster. Is that kind of giving you a hint of how they do it? They digitize the information?
More so with the sound, right, Emily?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both the video and the sound. The sound kind of freaks me out.
Okay, so they do the same thing with the sound, and depending, you can break down. Okay, if you're interested in this from a technical way, look up the two words Nyquist limit on Wikipedia. Nyquist, Nyquist limit. And so basically says that if you want to record sound clearly up to 20,000 hertz, you've got to sample it at double that, 40,000 times. So you get a block of sound coming in, and then you take a snapshot of it every 40,000th of a second. Bang, 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 bang. You do that 40,000 times, and you've got these 40,000 separate snapshots, and that's 1 second of sound. And then, in each snapshot, you then break it into the high frequencies and the low frequencies, and you record each of those as a digital thing. There's a huge amount of processing going on, but less than for vision. So it's the same concept, that you take the real analog world where things can vary seamlessly from here to there, and you break it up into little steps. It can be jerky unless you make the steps very small. And nowadays, the processes are easily fast enough that for vision and sound, the steps are so small that it can look like and sound like reality. I mean, not nowadays, for decades.
Mm.
Is that kind of helping? This is a big topic I've tried to summarise there.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Okay, so look up Nyquist limit and you'll probably pick up something by osmosis from that.
Awesome, thank you.
This homework, we'll ring you up to check whether you've done it.
Whether you've done
it. We'll give you an exam. We're expecting you to get 85%, Emily.
Mm-hmm. Emily texting and saying, I don't understand it. It just freaks me out. I love that.
It does, and it's really weird the way that it actually sounds real, but you're thinking, how could it possibly be like that? I guess it's like looking at how sausages are made.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of weird, but they taste nice.
They do taste good. We've got Alex in Tassie here. Alex, what's your question?
Hi, Dr. Carl. I read some news articles recently about octopus farms and how scientists are a bit worried about them because octopi could be sentient. I'm just sort of wondering what it means for animals to be sentient and whether or not people should, like, farm and eat sentient animals.
That is a really big question. It started off with Peter Singer, and he wrote a book in the 60s or 70s called Animal Something or Other, and he's a philosopher, and he's talking about the whole thing of eating sentient creatures. Octopuses are a special case. They seem to be frighteningly intelligent, have got a greater mass of brain per body weight than we have. They've got a central brain plus eight other brains in their limbs. And they reach an incredibly high level of capability, considering that there's no passing on of knowledge from one generation to the next. So the male octopus hands over the sperm and starts to die. The female fertilizes her eggs with the sperm, manually, and then with a tentacle. And then once she puts them out to hatch, then she begins to die. And there's no passing on of knowledge from one generation to the next. And yet they get to be incredibly accomplished. And it'd be interesting if there was a mutation such that they began to live in colonies. And so there'd be some middle-aged octopuses, say half a year old, that could then pass on their knowledge to the next generation of baby octopuses. So that's one thing about octopuses that you mentioned, they're incredibly intelligent. The other thing is the concept of sentient. And for a long time, people have thought that animals were sentient, they had consciousness and awareness and all that sort of stuff. And then there was a very narrow school of psychology that arose in the early 1920s that said, no, the animals don't have consciousness, they're just a bunch of reflexes. If it's hot, they'll go into the shade. If it's cold, they'll go into the sunlight. If they're hungry, they'll eat. And there's nothing more to them than that. And they don't have love. And, of course, that was stupid, but it hung for a while. And now we're coming back to it. And now you're raising the deep philosophical question of, should we eat sentient animals? And even, should we eat animals at all? My daughter Alice has gone off that. I remember the moment, bolognese was really delicious and part of everything. And one day she saw some sheep in the field. And my son said, that's what we eat, that's bolognese. And then she gave up being a meat eater at that moment.
Mm.
So I've kind of followed her a bit on that. I don't know, where do we go with this sentient thing? What are you doing with it? Alex, are you a vegetarian now?
I stopped eating meat because I was worried about the environmental impact. I just read that it's a lot more efficient to grow plants and eat them. And since doing that, I've been thinking a bit more about the welfare stuff, yeah.
Mm.
It is a tricky issue. Certainly, if you grow soybeans and then feed the soybeans to cattle, that is just so inefficient. Just eat the soybeans, and I love soybeans. You do get certain things from meat that are difficult to get from the outside world, but you can, if you read Claire Collins, C-L-A-R-E Collins, on The Conversation, you can even be a vegan and be pregnant and have a perfectly healthy pregnancy all the way through being totally vegan. And you can raise a baby as a vegan, but that's really hard because you've got to cut back on the carbohydrates and the fiber and increase the fats, but you can do it. It can be done with knowledge. So it's certainly not impossible to be perfectly healthy and be vegetarian or vegan.
But also, Dr. Carl, we had a question earlier about lasagna, about bolognese, about tomato-based foods that taste better the next day or several days later. Tim texted in saying when some foods are moistened, they actually need more time to soak moisture up so they can express more flavours. As it soaks longer, more flavours are expressed.
I really wish I'd studied food chemistry. Thank you, Dr. Tim.
Jared, you got a question about helium.
Guys. So my wife and I were actually watching the movie Horton Hears a Who, where the elephant sucks in a lot of air to try and become wider when he crosses the bridge. And then it made us think of something funny that, you know, if when you, like, suck in the helium of a balloon, would you actually become wider? Like, would you lose weight or would you just stay the same?
The best way to think about it is like a lump of wood on the ground. So a lump of wood on the ground has a certain weight, but then when you put it in water, its effective weight is less because it's being buoyed up by the water around it. Now, imagine you were to then, while it's floating in the water, and so we are floating in air, and that removes some of the weight. The weight that we have is slightly less than if we were being weighed in a vacuum. Now, if you shave off some of the wood, it would become light if you remove some of the atoms or expand the volume. In the case of the helium, there's stuff inside your lungs, air, and it can be a few litres. And if you have fewer and lighter atoms, if they're more further, then your effective weight is less. So having uncompressed helium in your lungs would make you fractionally, let me emphasise, fractionally lighter. But it wouldn't be much. So what did the elephant do? It sucked in air to get lighter when it walked across a bridge?
Yeah, so it was supposed to be a bit of a joke, but then I put it to my wife. I'm like, well, if you did that, but with helium like a balloon, do you technically become lighter?
I reckon you would. And by the way, air is not weightless. It has a weight of about 1.25 kilograms per cubic metre. So the best thing for the elephant to have done would have been to remove the air from its lungs, because it's made of atoms and the atoms have weight. But hey, it's a movie. I like the vibe.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks for that, Dr. Carl.
Thanks, Jared. We've got Paul in Canberra here. Paul, what's your question?
Yeah, look, my dad taught me this old trick of using butter to clean grease off your hands. Say if you're working on an old car or metalworking, just always wondered why that works.
Ah, so if you get stuff on your hands and you want to wash it off, you then come across the two big divisions in the chemical world in this field, which are water and fat. If you've got water-soluble chemicals on your hands, just washing your hands in water will remove them. But if they've got some degree of fat, then what you've got to do is put fatty stuff on your hands, which will then remove and absorb some of the fat, and then you've got to push that fat away. And that's the beauty of soap. So soap molecules, at one end, they've got a bit that loves fat, and so it sticks to the fat. And on the other end, there's a bit that loves water. So it's the combination of having it on your hands, the soap, and then the rubbing, and that then lets it go into the water and get washed away. So going down the drain is a molecule that has fat on one end, which is what was on your hand originally, and then some water molecules on the other end, which is sticking to the other end. So with butter is soft and gloopy enough that you can just simply rub it off your hands. You will have a little bit of a residue. You'll have a bit of an oily residue, but then you can just use the milder soap and then it'll take that last bit of fat off.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow,
yeah,
so that's a good old trick. I never came across that one before. I'm going to have to try that. Instead of using that special stuff you get from the automotive store, which has got little grits in it, which is really good at removing the dirt. But on the other hand, they're microplastics, so maybe we should all go back to butter and water and soap.
I agree.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Dr. Paul.
Now, we were chatting earlier about why food like lasagna or spaghetti bolognese sometimes tastes better the next day. We've got Melinda here, who is a gut health dietitian. Melinda, can you shed some light on this?
Yeah, so I just wanted to mention that there's natural food chemicals in food, and it's all different types of food. And for those ones that get yummier, it's actually a food chemical called amines that are in the food. So, and things like your meat have amines in it. And as that protein breaks down, as you're cooking it or over time, it increases that amount of amines in it. And they're yummy, like it gets yummier the higher the amines are in that food. And also as certain foods ripen, like tomatoes. So that could be a reason why things like lasagna and curries taste nicer the next day. Because you'll either just give it that length of time for the amines to increase, or even heating and then reheating again is going to increase that amine level in the food.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Melinda. I'm so glad that we had an expert in the field ring in. And am I right in saying that amines have an NH2 group in them, which is nitrogen and two hydrogens? That's going back to, is my memory correct on that?
Yep.
Oh, okay. So the amines can be building blocks of proteins?
Yeah.
But they're different from amino acids.
Yeah, so they're histamines is another form, another type of amines. And different types of amino acid groups, and as they increase in levels, as that protein breaks down to the smaller components, it then results in an increased yumminess and flavour to the food.
Wow, thank you so much, Dr. Melinda.
Oh, Melinda, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Lexi, you've got a science fair coming up. What has your group decided to work on?
So my group's decided to work on, we're making electricity out of potatoes.
Electricity out of potatoes, right.
Yeah.
So what do you want Dr. Carl's assistance on? Will you credit him in your final piece?
Absolutely.
Well, the easiest way is just to have two and here's a fancy word, dissimilar, which is a fancy word meaning different. Have two different metals, and you shove them into a potato. The only role of the potato is to allow wet contact from one metal to the other. It could be a lemon, it could be an orange, it could be an apple, it doesn't matter. And but the thing is, you've got these two different metals, maybe zinc and iron. If you go to Wikipedia and look up electronegativity, try and pick the two metals, electronegativity, that have got the biggest difference. And the biggest, the bigger the difference, so the electricity is coming from the different metals, and the metals will corrode. Effectively, they're doing a kind of a rusting. And you should be able to get enough electricity to run a small LED or power up a speaker, and so you'll be able to feed a electrical signal into it, say through, you can Bluetooth some audio into it, and then it will do the amplifying, and you might have enough, you might have to get a series of potatoes together. But remember, you're getting the electricity from the different electronegativities of the metals. The potato is just something wet, so it's not giving much electricity. But on the other hand, there is electricity in our bodies, about 100 amperes, and we've discovered that with animals, we can fool around with this electricity, and we can make wounds heal faster or slower, and in animals, we can make the cancers reverse. We haven't been able to do that in humans because we haven't started yet. Electricity, bioelectricity is a whole new field that's just opening up again.
Does that help you, Ash?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, good luck with the assessment. We've got Emma in Melbourne here. Emma.
So, yeah, hi. I live out towards the Macedon Ranges on a small property, and one of our bugbears is the wind. And obviously today out here, I don't know what it's like where you are, but it is extremely windy. And our granddaughters asked us once where wind starts and ends, I guess, and you know, is it just something? And I guess my question is, that in itself, does it start and end somewhere, or is it just a continual sort of breeze or light wind just going around the earth, and it just increases in intensity based on, you know, weather conditions, I guess. I don't know.
Well, on average, the sun dumps about 340 watts of power on each square metre of the Earth's surface, averaging out from pole to pole and across the equator and day and night. Now, that heats up the ground, but it heats up the ground unevenly. So the black dirt will absorb more heat than white shiny concrete. And so the air above the black dirt will get hotter and it will rise, and then the air will come across from the white concrete, and that movement of air is what we call a wind. So then you do it on a large scale over a continent, and then you have these large scale winds, and then you start the Earth rotating, and then that sets up things called Hadley cells. Look that up in Wikipedia, H-A-D-L-E-Y cells. And then so the overall cause of the wind is temperature differences combined with the rotation of the Earth. But we've recently discovered, it's still a little bit controversial, that forests and trees generate wind. They don't generate wind by waving their arms, but rather they transpire water from the soil through their roots, through their leaves, and into the atmosphere, and that leads to local temperature changes, which once again means that there's different amounts of wind following the hot or the cold air. So the hotter air will rise and the colder air will drop, and then once again, that's a source of wind. So there's your main thing about wind.
And we've got that question for Toby on behalf of Alana. What do you want to know?
Dr. Carl, my daughter would love to know, is there friction in space?
Yes, friction is something that happens between one surface and another, and it's the electron clouds on one material interacting with the electron clouds on another material, assuming they're both very smooth. If they're bumpy, of course there'll be friction. If you've got big bumps and you like a sandpaper and you're trying to push one bit of sandpaper over another, of course that'll happen whether there's an atmosphere or not. But if you've got perfectly smooth surfaces, you've still got the almost atomic cloud interaction. Look up van der Waals forces in Wikipedia. Van, V-A-N, der, D-E-R, Waal, W-A-A-L.
Excellent.
There's some homework for you.
Thanks, Toby and Alana. Dr. Jake, what's your question?
G'day, guys. How you going?
Good.
And your question or comment?
Yeah, so I was wondering, when you sneeze, when you have to sneeze, I've always, like, you look up at the sun, you look at the light, and sometimes my wife, she'll get the torch on her phone, she'll turn it towards her eyes to make herself sneeze. This is only the case with some people, though. I've got some friends that it doesn't work for them, but it works 100% of the time for me. So every time I need to sneeze, if I can't quite get there, I look up at the sun or I get the torch out. And I was just wondering if there was any reason behind that or if it's just like a placebo.
It's real. It's called the photic reflex, P-H-O-T-I-C reflex. Look it up in Wikipedia. It happens in 3% of the population, ranging from the really soft end where you want to sneeze and you can feel the sneeze building up but it won't come, so you stare at the sun for a second and bang, it comes. Or it can be at the other end, possibly like you, where driving on a road at sunset and there's shadows coming from one side and each time you go into the sunlight you sneeze and this can interfere with your vision, and that's why they started looking at it in the Second World War when the pilots were coming out of the clouds. It is a real phenomenon, and I've written a story about it. Check up ABC, Dr. Carl, sneeze, sun, and you'll find that you're just like us. You're like the rest of us. We love you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. If you want to catch up on previous episodes, collaborations, or join the fam, make sure you are subscribed. This ep was produced by Lou Hill. I'm Lucy Smith, and we will catch you next week.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.